before I get started. But this morning we're talking about Luke 22, 47 through 65. And as you can tell, I didn't even try this time to come up with the title because it's really difficult to know how to title this. But these two sections, and that's what I see them as, really kind of go together. And Luke, I will say, does these sections different than anyone else. But if you're able to stand with me, we will read our passage together and pray. And then as we finish up, it'll go right into the Lord's table. Starting in verse 47, it says this: "While he was still speaking, behold, a crowd came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was preceding them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, 'Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?' When those who were around him saw what was going to happen, they said, 'Lord, shall we strike with a sword?' And one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus answered and said, 'Stop, no more of this.' And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and the elders who had come against him, 'Have you come out with swords and clubs as you would against a robber? While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this hour and the power of darkness are yours.' Having arrested him, they led him away, brought him to the house of the high priest, but Peter was following at a distance. After they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and had sat down together, Peter was sitting among them. And a servant girl, seeing him as he sat in the firelight and looking intently at him, said, 'This man was with him too.' But he denied it, saying, 'Woman, I do not know him.' A little later, another saw him and said, 'You are one of them too.' But Peter said, 'Man, I am not.' After an hour had passed, another man began to insist, saying, 'Certainly this man also was with him, for he is a Galilean too.' But Peter said, 'Man, I do not know what you are talking about.' Immediately while he was still speaking, a rooster crowed. The Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had told him before, 'A rooster crows today, you will deny me three times.' And he went out and wept bitterly. Now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him and beating him, and they blindfolded him and were asking him, saying, 'Prophesy, who is the one who hit you?' And they were saying many other things against him, blasphemy." You may be seated. Well, you'll notice the theme. And by the way, if you were to, by chance, look at all the gospel accounts, some of you may be familiar. If you ever, by the way, are curious, they're usually pretty good. There's a way you can take the accounts and it's called the Gospel Parallels, I think is one of them, a book where they try to put things, you know, kind of where they fit. But if you were to look at this and look at the other three Gospels, you'll notice some things are included in Luke, some things are not. I do want to highlight that because I think that's important, because we always have to ask, in Luke's Gospel, why does he include some things and not others? Well, there's a point to it, right? There's a point to it because it's what he wants to emphasize from everything that has happened. So we will be doing that. But, you know, one of the things I'm going to tell you right off the bat, this is why I'm telling you this. I believe this account shows us that the arrest is God ordained. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, let's get right into our passage. So in verses 47 and 48, we pick up, this is after the prayer. And if you recall, when he came to the disciples, they were sleeping from sorrow. He was prepared now for what was about to unfold. And then immediately we're told by Luke, we're seeing a crowd that shows up with Judas. Now, if you notice very carefully in verse 47, other than Judas, is anyone else, any group identified? No. Now, if you look at the other Gospels, it is, but not here. So Luke is emphasizing something here, right? And the emphasis is, well, if you're only talking about one man amongst this crowd of people that have come, we're supposed to think, oh, wow. Judas is kind of the focal point right now. The Gospel of John lets us know that there was a Roman cohort, which is about a tenth of a legion, let's say 60-ish men. And there were also the temple guard. They were the representatives of the Sanhedrin, the officials of Israel. They also came as arresting officers. But what's unique is, in this account, Judas is pictured as being like front and center. In fact, it literally is. It's like Judas is the one who shows up, even though there's a whole bunch of other people. It says Judas was preceding them. He's front and center, leading the crowd to location. He's shown approaching Jesus to greet him with a kiss. Now, for some of us, it's not the way we typically think of a greeting, although there are certain cultures that do that. And when we say kiss, just so you know, so the word there is phileme, which is from the root word of phileo. Phileo, by the way, we think of what brotherly love. And of course, we think of Philadelphia where the riots are having, where there's a lot of brotherly love there, right? I just always think of, you know, do you know that the Philadelphia Eagles Stadium, at least at the beginning, was one of the only football stadiums that had a jail actually in their stadium? Sounds like a fun place to visit, doesn't it? Well, they may all have them now, the way things have gotten out of hand. But this is the greeting. So it's kind of that greeting of affection that would be typical of family. Now, as I'm reading through the commentators, and they're kind of talking even about this part, they're like, you know, it's funny because as we read through the accounts, you don't read about Jesus getting greeted very often this way. So this is actually probably pretty strange the way Judas comes up to him, to be honest with you. Because, I mean, seriously, if you think through, reading through the Gospels, do you really ever read Jesus getting greeted this way? Well, first of all, if you're just based off of the Word, you're not going to see that. Obviously we know, why is this strange? Well, do you know that was supposed to be Jude's signal? And I think it's also being pointed out, and you say, well, what about the other Gospels don't necessarily talk about this? But Luke does, because Luke wants to say this is so obvious that this is what's going on. And if you don't greet someone normally in a certain way, it does seem odd. So if, let's say, I approach my wife, Julie, when she comes home after school and I kneel down and kiss her hand, she would not say, oh, this is my customary greeting. She would like, okay, what did you break? Be like, this is odd. What's going on here? This is strange. This is not customary, right? I don't think this was customary greeting for Judas. It's not that this wasn't a greeting that people would have. It's just obviously not something that was going on very often. And so Jesus, as we're told in verse 48, asks him this rhetorical question. Are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? And of course, Matthew and Mark, as I alluded to, tell us that the signal for identification with Jesus with a guard is the greeting of a kiss, right? But when Jesus asked the question, there's a contrast, right? So you have this greeting, which is supposed to be this phileo kind of greeting of brotherly family love. But the contrast is, he says, are you betraying with this type of a greeting? And then he doesn't just say, are you betraying, but he doesn't say, are you betraying me? He says, but are you betraying the Son of Man? It emphasizes this betrayal was God's servant, the Son of Man, the divine ruler, the Son of Man, this promised Messiah. I also think the reason Luke wants to emphasize it this way is he's highlighting the fact that Jesus controls the narrative here. If you don't know any better and you just think, well, poor Jesus, he had no idea this was coming. Doesn't seem to be what he said at the table. when he instituted what we refer to as the Lord's Supper, the Lord's table, or some people call it communion. No, he talked about the betrayer. What was he praying about? What was going to happen? He recognizes what's going to happen. Before they come, he says, time to what? To his disciples who were sleeping, get up. Don't enter into temptation. And then he says this, and by the way, if he knew he was coming to he could have, if you want to say, he could have stopped things right there. But instead, he points out, you're betraying the Son of Man. So the question I have is, with this, just looking at these two verses compared to the way the other Gospels lay these events out, what is Luke drawing our attention to? One thing, and I didn't highlight this earlier, all the other Gospels mentioned that there were soldiers and they had weapons. Luke doesn't say anything about it. He's silent about this. Why? Well, I think the emphasis is what Luke wants to point out. He doesn't want to bring these things up. It goes back to what Jesus was wrestling with in prayer. The whole prayer was, Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will but yours be done. So he knew this was so important. He knew this was part of it. So Luke is trying to emphasize that instead of bringing out they had weapons, that's not why Jesus does this. He's not like, oh boy, they've got weapons. What am I going to do? The reason for what transpires has nothing to do with the fear of those bearing weapons. That's why I believe Luke doesn't include this element. The other thing is, by identifying only Judas in the crowd, he puts the emphasis on the one who is betraying rather than all the others that are carrying out the plans. Because by emphasizing Judas, and Jesus has known all along that he would be betrayed by him, and so this is all part of God's plan. So therefore, that's why when I thought about grouping this section together, I would call it, this arrest is God ordained. I know I've said this before, but I have to point it out, and it was, hopefully I haven't told you before, so when the Passion of the Christ came out, I mentioned about, like, it was in a small town in Kansas in a movie theater, and we all talked about as churches. It's one of the few things we could cooperate on because several of them didn't really believe Jesus was the only way. So about the only thing we cooperate on is how do we help out the poor people by pooling our money together, you know, for like transients that might come through Johnson County. And then the other thing was a few events we might do. And so we said, okay, why don't we each just kind of designate a time our church will go and we can each kind of have our own outreach for that time. And that's what we did. And so, but I remember talking with one of the pastors of a church that really struggled with getting the gospel straight, right? And I was making small talk with the guy. I really didn't want to talk theology because I knew where his theology was, all over the place. But I just made small talk. Oh, what'd you think of the movie? Because I hadn't seen it yet. And I'm glad actually I went and saw the movie before then we hosted it that night. He said, you know, my wife, she just loves Shakespeare. She would just go again and again, but she went once and she couldn't go again. And she said, but she came away, she was so mad at the Romans for what happened. Because somehow, if it wasn't for those Romans, Jesus wouldn't have been crucified, is basically what he was implying. That's not the picture painted in the Gospels. That's why I bring this up. That's a great analogy because a lot of people don't get it. This was Jesus willingly going to the cross for us. In fact, as the rest unfolds, here's what's fascinating. You see this because verses 49 through 51, look at this. It tells us, I've got to read it again. When those who were around him saw what was going to happen, it hadn't happened yet, they said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? So they've got some swords. The disciples are ready to protect their Messiah. And as someone pointed out, and I agree, the question was not so much a request for permission as an announcement of the action that they're intending to take. You ever ask that question? Well, it's really, really not asking the question. Well, I think, don't you think we should go ahead and go do this? Sometimes when the question is phrased that way, it's like, I've already decided it is. I'm just kind of telling you, this is what I'm doing. So clearly it does happen because they feel like they've got to take matters in their own hands because Jesus is going to be arrested. Now, they have been told of the impending betrayal. This is not a surprise. In fact, it didn't catch on, but Jesus said, do you remember who the disciples were that fell asleep? Was one of them Peter? Peter, don't what? Fall into temptation. And not just Peter, right? It's not mentioned here in verse 50, but the Gospel of John identifies Peter as the one that takes out his sword. And he strikes the slave of the high priest. He said, no, wait. He said it struck his ear. Well, Peter didn't go up and say, I'm going to get you. I'm going to get your ear. He came at his head. The slave turns the head in such a way so it just strikes the ear. I'm sure it hit his head. Head's a lot stronger than you think. The skull is. But it got that ear. At that point in time, evidently, he was probably a one-eared man. I don't know if the whole thing came off, but... And by the way, the type of sword that's mentioned in the Greek lets us know it was a smaller sword. We're not talking about a big, broad sword, because you're thinking, well, how do you just get the sword? Well, it was a smaller one. But most likely, he's aiming for the servant's head, and probably what happens is he turns in such a way, slices the ear. Now think, I mean, it's bold. Again, this would be Peter, right? I mean, what follows next? We're going to say it about Peter what? Peter, you wimped out. No, it wasn't really about wimping out. In fact, look at his actions. Peter's not a coward. He really isn't. Peter is a human being, though. And if you haven't figured out, we'll talk about this, that means you're a failure. Because, number one, you're a sinner. But number two, then trying to do things in your own strength, you'll be a failure. This is what happens. You know, Peter was definitely devoted to Jesus to stop such a thing, but you can be devoted and you can still be sincerely wrong. And he was sincerely wrong. So he puts a stop to it, as we're told, right? Jesus said, stop, no more of this. He's not going to allow this to be an insurrection. And so Luke summarizes the response of what is happening. The other Gospels add more of what was going on. Matthew tells us that he had told Peter to put your sword back into its place. For all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Which is obviously what? A reminder. Violence will be met with violence. And that's not what Jesus was coming here to do. In addition, Matthew records Jesus telling them that God the Father could dispense with legions of angels if Jesus needed that. Like, do you realize that? This is so foolish. I could have angels in a second take care of this. But that's not what Jesus is about. The other thing is that's not in Luke's account, but it's in the Gospel of John. Jesus says to Peter about the cup, he says, the cup which the Father has given me, shall I not drink it? So Jesus identifies this period of time with the cup. And so what that would imply, what? Do you want to fight against my mission? Because that's what he was just praying about. Excruciatingly praying about the cup. Do you want to fight against that mission, Peter? So what does Jesus do? He heals the slave. Why? Well, because it's not what he's there for. Because the guy's got a serious boo-boo. He's hurting. But someone else pointed something out. I've got to give him credit for it. I really try not to take people's quotes and quote them, because then you would know that's not how you normally talk, Steve. So I'm not going to do that. But I think Dr. Tom Constable brings a very important point in what Jesus heals. So what he's going to tell you, I'll tell you before I show you the quote, because then you'll read the quote and maybe tune me out. He's saying what Jesus ends up doing in response to the violence is so opposite of what they wanted to do when faced with the arrest, right? Dr. Tom Constable notes that. He says, Jesus reversed the damage done by healing the servant. He did what he had previously told the disciples to do, namely, do good to your enemies rather than evil. We live in a world that does not want to do that. Do you believe that? Do you believe people want to do good to their enemies in this world? Absolutely not. I'm not saying it's easy, by the way. Do good to your enemies rather than evil. So as he says, again, Luke is noting Jesus' compassion, even for those who sought to kill him, because that's what the arrest was really about. It's going to be a kangaroo court. It's going to be a joke. But Jesus did not rely on the sword, nor did he establish his messianic kingdom on the use of physical force. This is what we see unfold. And then the other thing is, in what closes this section about the betrayal, the arrest, right? Jesus then addresses the whole situation with the crowd. He addresses the whole crowd. Then we're told who's there, right? It says he addresses the chief priests, the officers of the temple, the elders who had come against him. He doesn't mention the Roman soldiers because they're there really to keep the peace and do whatever's necessary to get this taken care of. What a contrast. And he asked them if they're coming out to him as if he were some type of robber they were coming to battle. Because he says, do you come out with swords and clubs as you would against a robber? They're showing quite a force in light of how many are out there. You got Jesus minus one, well, 12 minus one, because Judas is out there on the other side. You got 11, you got 12. Most likely, if we're going to take the numbers, I would say at the minimum, because we don't know how much of the temple guards, I would bet you they've easily got 100, maybe more. It's not like somebody's packing a machine gun, like, oh, we better bring the whole force. You didn't have machine guns. That's not why. It's overkill. In fact, Jesus questions them about the timing of events, right? Now, when I say he questions, well, it says, while I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours. So on the one hand, he's questioning what they're doing because this is done when? In the darkness of night, in secret. Now, we know, Lucas said it, all the gospel accounts tell us that these brave religious leaders are afraid of the people. This is why it's done in secret. They're not going to do it in broad daylight. That's why Jesus brings us out. Hey, you know, Jesus was not Deion Sanders when he says, I know you know where to find me. That's not what he's saying. But what he's saying is, I'm right here, out in the open. I'm here. Not as a way to say, you know, why don't you come challenge me? He was saying, why didn't you do this earlier? But the reason he brings this up in one sense is to say, this is what sin does. It's done in secret, right? Sin doesn't want to work out in the daylight, in the open. Yet, there's a timing of events because, you know, oftentimes we read in the Bible about the hour is at hand. Jesus says it. What does that tell us typically? What is the hour at hand, really? On the one hand, we see that language that's used to kind of talk about a time of destiny, right? You know, Luke says, this hour and power of darkness are yours. This is saying that God has allowed this opportunity to exist to fulfill this mission. This is why they could arrest him. If Jesus did not want to be arrested when he tells them at the Last Supper, in fact, it doesn't say it in Luke, but it says it in the other gospel accounts, he dismisses Judas. Nobody understands because they think there's the guy handling the money. We're not expecting him. You don't think Jesus could have figured out a way for Judas to got lost? To not go somewhere where he would be expected? He knew exactly where he was going, what was going to happen. So this is why it's all part of the cup that Jesus is expected to take. But there's something else I want you to notice in this phrase. Did you notice when verse 53, when you read, this hour and the power of darkness. Did you notice that little phrase, power of darkness? What could that mean? Well, what do we think of the power of darkness? We think of not just sin, but we think of spiritual warfare, right? Satanic. Daryl Bach notes, the drama is not merely a human one. The power of darkness lies behind this human activity. The battle is of cosmic proportions, with the people on stage mere players in a larger game. The domain of evil is present. Jesus fights. By the way, you think about Judas. Remember who it says entered into Judas. It was Satan. So Jesus fights this battle, not with weapons of war, but with armaments of character, is what Daryl Bach notes. Specifically, how does he respond? Heals the servant. Darkness must fall before a new day can come. It is the time when darkness reigns. We get to the cross. We talk about that period of darkness. So this is the first section. Now, we should come away saying, this is because this is God's plan, right? I hope that's what you think. Maybe you thought that before you ever even showed up this morning. But I think it makes it very clear, especially the way Luke has drawn this out for us. I want you to see this. But I also think he wants to draw this out, and that is human failure. Because that's the next thing that's brought up. The other Gospels don't do it quite like this. But if we look at verses 54 and 55, we are at the palace. Well, now I know it doesn't say palace, right? It says, having arrested him, they led him away and brought him to the house of the high priest. Well, I'm going to tell you, the high priest is not living in a house like you and I. Number one, it's big enough to have a trial in. I don't think they could have had a trial in my house. I don't think it's big enough. But number two, I mean, it's a political position that being a chief priest, right? Or maybe you didn't realize that. That is, it was kind of an appointed position. Now, it wasn't that way in the Old Testament. But it is by the time you get to the first century. Yeah, it's supposed to be this religious position, but it's also a political appointment. So I'm not surprised. The chief priest would have a nice house, a palace. And what's the point? Well, that's where the Sanhedrin meets. And the Sanhedrin, by the way, is the highest Jewish council. It had probably 70 members and was presided over by the high priest. Now, some of you may be confused because in the Gospel of John, it mentions being taken to Annas. Well, that is Annas, the former high priest. It was probably designed, and some speculate, and this would make sense, they had to gather everyone together once they arrested Jesus. So they may have taken him there first before they to gather the Sanhedrin before they brought him to the house to be able to actually go through this kangaroo court, this trial. Peter, we're told, is where? It says Peter's sitting among them. Where? Well, they're in the courtyard. So as they scatter as he's arrested, Peter knows where they're at, follows at a close distance. He is willing, by the way, There's one other that's mentioned too, is John. But John's not sitting smack dab in the middle of the court. Peter is. He's sitting around the fire. It's still dark enough. He's sitting where all the other servants are, awaiting the outcome, if you will. They're just kind of there waiting. Where do we go next? But if you're sitting out there around the fire, there's a good chance somebody might spot you. And Peter is spotted in verses 56 and 57. Who is it? It says a servant girl. Let's get to the chase. It's a slave girl. We're told in Mark that this was the servant girl for the high priest. It's significant because she would have been serving the high priest in the temple. It would be familiar with Jesus because Jesus was there a number of times with his disciples in the temple because he would teach there. So I don't know about you, but, you know, sometimes you go places, you kind of notice people if you like to people watch. Some people don't. But it probably would be fascinating, I would think, if you're kind of around where Jesus is teaching, you're finding out, who are these people coming around Jesus all the time? He's got this group, about 12 of them with him. Now, maybe you don't know all their names. I'm not going to say, well, Peter... You know, Peter had a mullet. That's why they all recognize him. That's not what it doesn't tell us that, right? But you're going to notice some things. Well, for whatever reason, she is... Do you notice the way it's... You know, I can see the scene unfolding. Like they're sitting at the fire. And you know, sometimes when it's dark, you know, around a fire, you can't see as well, but you can look intently and start to notice the things through the light of the fire. And you start to say, huh. It says, by the way, verse 56, she's looking intently at him like, That's why she blurts out what she says. Oh, you're you're the man that was with Jesus too. Oh, no. Woman, I do not know him. I wonder if he said it as confidently as he answered Jesus when he said, I will go with you to death. I wonder if it was that strong of a statement. So that was the first time. And yeah, you know, we know where this is going. We've read it. Most of us have read this account before. Well, here we go to number two. Number two, does it get any easier to read? Well, you tell me. A little later, another saw him and said, you are one of them too. But Peter said, man, I am not. So a short time later, it says another slave recognizes Peter. Matthew 26:71 provides some greater detail. It says this, when he had gone out to the gateway, another servant girl saw him and said to those who were there, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. So there, the servant girl, another servant girl, slave girl, is talking with a group, right? So he's not talking directly to Peter, talking with a group. Because you may say, well, this one says, man. Well, at least that's the way Peter says. Well, it's because they're having a conversation. And Peter very emphatically says, no. The intensity of the situation is ramping up, so is Peter's denial. In fact, if you look at Matthew says, again, he denied it with an oath. The bigger the audience, the more emphatic Peter becomes to deny an association with Jesus publicly. And then we read the last failure, right? It says, this time, though, it's an hour. I don't know if that means that he's just kind of going to places away from people as he's waiting around. So this whole time of trial, it's a great period, which it would be because they're producing. Now, Luke's not concerned to tell us this right now. He just won't taking us right to Peter, but he's not telling us the details. Because he wants us to see Peter, focus on Peter. But after an hour... Another man began to insist, certainly this man was also with him, for he is Galilean too. Now, why did he bring that up? Well, Matthew tells us what gave away Peter was his speech, being from Galilee. It wasn't because they said y'all, because they're from Galilee. Well, see, I know. Or they say, you're fixing. That must be Galilean. Well, that's Texan. No, what is it? A Galilean dialect, this is what the Talmud mentions, was unique because of the guttural sounds were often hard to distinguish. Guttural. Now, when I think of guttural sounds, it's the and I would have to pronounce a word to sound better, but there is some, it feels like you're producing when you learn Hebrew. Is this right, Sheldon? You're producing phlegm on the back of your throat trying to pronounce these words. So there's something about it. There's three letters in particular where you make that noise. But evidently in that area, the way they pronounce them, it says it's really hard to distinguish what they're saying. I mean, has anybody ever run into someone from Louisiana that's Cajun and heard them talk? There's something unique about that. Sometimes you don't understand all the words they're saying. Julie smiling kind of. We were in New Orleans for 2 months working at Boys Town. We met a few people that were Cajun, and some of the words you're like, now what did they say? Can't understand. So there's something giving Peter away, and they say, well, you know, think about where his disciples were from. Boy, that makes you pretty guilty. So what does Peter do? Obviously, he denies Jesus. I do not know what you're talking about. He didn't just deny the association with Jesus. He denied any knowledge of who this Jesus character is. So in one sense, someone might say, it wasn't just denying association with him, kind of the whole existence of Jesus and all this. Like, I don't know, I even know what you're talking about is Jesus. It's like the strongest form of denial, some would say. So if that's really what's going on, you're having it just intensify each denial even stronger, right? And while Peter's talking, there's another noise that happens. It's the sound of a rooster. Now, to me, I don't know how Peter wouldn't have remembered this anyway, but Luke lets us know that Jesus turns and looks at Peter at this time. And it would seem odd to us because weren't they waiting for him and he's in trial? Well, while they're talking inside, the way to reconcile this account is to realize Jesus was most likely being led from the house of the chief priest to the next stage of the trial. And that's how they cross paths and make eye contact. We're not told the exact details, but Jesus sees him. That's all we're told. But it tells us that Peter is reminded that Jesus had told him this would happen 3 times. And how does Peter respond? Verse 62. He went out and wept bitterly. This is not just kind of crying. This is boo-hooing, I guess, is how some people would put it, right? Just one of those moments. I think guys probably, if we're honest, if we ever do cry, which I'm saying there's nothing wrong with it, but sometimes some of us who have a hard time crying, when we do cry, it's not pretty, is it? Especially you think about crying at the death of someone, and then when you do finally let it out, it's just affects your whole body. I can see this with Peter, like total failure. You know, I'm thinking about this. It's like all that's on the menu for Peter right now is disappointment and failure. That's all he can partake of. And by the way, it's going to get worse until the reunion. Because it leads to his departure, painful tears. And probably the disappointment that Peter was so strongly saying, I'm not going to leave you, Jesus. And, you know, here's the one that was going to ready to take someone's head off and now can't even admit. Well, I mean, let's be honest. Would he have probably gotten in trouble? Yeah, why wouldn't you arrest the guy like that? Because you want to find his other followers. You don't want the trouble. So, I mean, there's real pressure, right? It's not like made up. Oh, it's poor Peter. They're going to, you know, call him names. No, they'll probably throw him in jail and interrogate him, trying to get him to give up the other disciples. That's reality, right? It won't be a pleasant experience. That's the pressure that he has. So I'm not trying to make Peter into someone like, oh, well, he should have just hung in there and been tough. No, I just the reason this is pointed out is Peter was so strong in himself, or at least he thought he was. But, you know, the lesson has been learned over and over again because he could not stay awake to help pray with the Lord while Jesus was further along. And he comes and he is sleeping along with the other two. Because Peter's confidence was still in himself, and really all the disciples' confidence was in themselves until they realized they can't do that anymore. And really, I think the only way that finally gets realized is when Christ comes back from the dead. When Jesus is raised from the dead and he meets with them and there's restoration. There's, you know, you end a message like this and it's like, oh, great. When actually, I decided to throw in 63 and 65 to make this even more fun. Because it's not pleasant, right? But the thing is, this is trending towards like bad, depressing stuff. But, you know, if you tell someone the gospel, you really got to start there and say, it really is bad. We're not going to sugarcoat it. You are a failure because you are a sinner. You are at your core because of your heart. You are infected with sin. And it has caused you to have no relationship with God. And I can't sugarcoat that for you. And we see it played out in Peter, probably, and I would say probably the strongest of the 12 disciples. I don't think that's a problem to say that, do you? So then we get verse 63 and 65, and we have this rough ending, right? So it says, now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him and beating him, and they blindfolded him and were asking him, saying, prophesy, who's the one who hit you? And they were saying many other things against them, blasphemy. So the soldiers that were responsible for securing Jesus were brutalizing him. And we could say, well, was it just the Roman soldiers? I don't know if we can say that. It was just them. The other synoptic gospels report the guards spit in Jesus' face. They struck him with their fists. They slapped him. Is this a righteous trial? Are they handling this in a dignified, righteous way? No. You know the problem with you've heard the term social gospel, right? Social gospel is about, I got good news, we're going to change society now. Because that's why Jesus came to change society now. You know what? Jesus showed how wicked society is and that the only way it changes is through his death and resurrection. That's the real gospel. And if nothing else, if what you see is that there is nothing righteous that happens when mankind gets involved in it, it will be tainted with sin, affected by sin. And this is what we're reminded of. It isn't just cruel, it's childish. And so this is this horseplay at the expense of doing this whole, you know, blindfolding him, striking him. Hey, who did this? By the way, they're not the first ones to do it, you know? Did you realize? Maybe you did. I had to be reminded. This happened with a prophet one time. 1 Kings 22, verse 24. Zedekiah, the son of Chenaaha, came near and struck Micaiah on the cheek and said, How did the Spirit let pass, the Spirit of the Lord pass from me to speak to you? That's mocking him, right? Same kind of thing. Which, you know, I don't know why you'd want to mock God. You think this is the end? You get away with it. Oh, I got away with it. No, you really don't. And the other thing we notice is they're also guilty of speaking blasphemies, which all kinds of stuff. So here's a question for you about this section. And this really sets us up for the Lord's table, right? What is different about this gospel account from the others? In other words, what does Luke want us to emphasize, understand a little bit differently maybe than what Matthew's bringing out or Mark or John? Well, Luke, as you notice, went straight to the denials by Peter before saying anything about the trial in the palace of the high priest. So if this is really about God controlling the events and not Jesus being this unfortunate victim of circumstance, then he explains that why this is highlighted, right? Because this is all part of the plan, even though you have some who think they're going to change the plan. Even Peter, who doesn't want Jesus. Remember, Peter said, may it never be. Long time ago. He didn't want Jesus to die. I mean, we're not talking about just this last week of that we're reading in the Gospels. It was before that. And yet we're also emphasizes the steadfastness of Jesus to fulfill his mission of taking the cup. Because that's the hope for humanity, is that he took the cup. See, the strength of his disciples, and by the way, the strength of any human being who says, I'm just going to change the world, make it better, if that's what you're going to place your hope in, good luck. Because I have yet to see a program, I have yet to see a special group, special interest change anything in this world. It's not going to happen. The other thing is, the failure of Peter serves to demonstrate that if God doesn't intervene, we really don't have hope. And you know, when I think about hope, I think of a line in a hymn. Our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. That's what this shows us, right?